Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, musical notes to mark Corpus Christi. Bolsena, an unusual place of pilgrimage. June 1930. What happened on this date in the Vatican? Our popular Latin lover fills us in. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Let's begin today on a musical note with Monsignor Philip Whittemore. He brings us a musical comment on the feast of Corpus Christi.
At the Brigittine convent in Rome, the design on the tabernacle door shows a pelican feeding its young. With its long beak, the pelican bites its breast, releasing drops of blood to feed the young. That image has captured the imaginations of writers and artists over the centuries, from ancient Egypt right through to the present. Shakespeare and Dante both used it. And so did St. Thomas Aquinas in a hymn he wrote about the great gift of the Eucharist, when Christ feeds us with his own body and blood. The feast of Corpus Christi was established during St. Thomas's lifetime. He probably wrote many of the prayers we use in the liturgy on this feast. And he also wrote some fine hymns in honour of the Blessed Sacrament. Not only Adoro Te, that we just heard, but also O Salutaris Ostia and Tantum Ergo, that we sing at benediction. The Church's teaching on the Eucharist is explored thoroughly in St. Thomas's theological writings, but the heart of it is expressed beautifully and simply in his Eucharistic hymns. O Thou, our reminder of Christ crucified, living bread, the life of us for whom he died, lend this life to me then, feed and feast my mind. There be Thou the sweetness man was meant to find. St. Thomas develops the idea of the pelican feeding its young with its own blood. One drop of our Lord's precious blood, he says, is enough to redeem the world. So you often see a pelican used in Christian art as a symbol for the Eucharist. Corpus Christi College in Oxford, founded just before the Reformation, has a pelican proudly perched on top of the column in the front quadrangle. Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever tried translating Latin hymns into English. It isn't easy. And if you want to try and use the same plainsong tune for the English version, you really need to be a genius. Fortunately, a genius was at hand to translate St. Thomas's Adoro Te in the person of the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. Another skillful translator of Latin hymns was Edward Caswall, a priest who entered the Birmingham Oratory shortly after it was founded by John Henry Newman in the mid-19th century. Father Caswall's name crops up everywhere in Catholic hymn books, mainly for his translations, but also for some texts of his own, like See Amid the Winter's Snow and O Jesus Christ, Remember. Let's listen now to his translation of St. Thomas's Adoro Te. O Godhead hid, devoutly I adore thee.
Thank you.
That tune is called Aquinas, appropriately enough, and it was written by Sir Richard Terry, First Master of Music at Westminster Cathedral. The cathedral is dedicated to the Most Precious Blood, and as you enter the Blessed Sacrament Chapel there, you see a lovely bronze pelican lovingly shedding its blood. As we celebrate the Feast of Corpus Christi, we could use this hymn to help us in our prayer. The words of St. Thomas, translated by Gerard Manley Hopkins or by Edward Caswell, offer us plenty of food for thought and food for prayer.
Thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Now, on a different note, let's join Jill Bevilacqua as she goes on a pilgrimage to Bolsena and recounts for us an extraordinary event.
There's a journey I've made many times, in recent years with a dear friend, but originally as an essential part of a regular family holiday. Every year, sometime in August, when the children were small, we'd pile into the old station wagon and head for the Tuscan hills to spend a few days with friends who lived in a rambling old farmhouse on the slopes of Monte Amiata. The journey took about 3 hours, so as you have to make frequent stops when travelling with small children, we had our favourite ones. And the best of all was the halfway stop. After climbing for some time, the car would round a bend and gradually begin to slow down. Immediately, the little ones would crowd to the windows and peer out excitedly. Soon there'd be a shriek, "There it is!" And there'd be a general scramble to get out first and stand by the roadside, looking down at it. The Lake of Bolsena, shimmering blue in the August sunshine, its two tiny islands barely visible in the heat haze. There are some places we know only superficially, either for their importance regarding an event or a person, or because we've often passed through it on our way to somewhere else. For years, Bolsena was for me one of those places. On our annual summer journey, we didn't even pass through it, for our route took us past it, but high up, not down in the town or beside the lake. But years later, when the family had flown the nest, I came to know it close at hand, and on many occasions have walked by it and observed its changing moods. For in a matter of moments, it can be transformed from a tranquil pool to a wild, raging sea. Lake Bolsena, or Volsinia, to give it its Etruscan name, is Italy's largest lake of volcanic origin. Its two islands are what remains of ancient craters. In the course of the centuries, its level has been continually modified by earthquakes. And a nature guide to the area has this curious note.
The lake was celebrated in antiquity because of the phenomenon of the flowering of the waters, described by Pliny, and for its eels, recorded by Dante and Petrarch.
And what was the flowering of the waters? Simply the result of the algae, the seaweed, which grew there, and which every summer would burst into flower to the delight of all who passed by. And not only was the lake famous for its eels, but also for its abundant supply of fish. But where does the miracle come in? Well, I did eventually go to Bolsena on a parish pilgrimage. And what exactly happened in Bolsena, and why? The story is probably familiar to most of us. A priest has doubts about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But as he's celebrating Mass one day, an extraordinary thing happens. Let's go back a little in time. In the early centuries of the Church, the scholars tell us, the doctrine of the Eucharist was not a subject of controversy, and therefore the need for precise formulation would not arise. But in the 9th century, a monk named Pascasius Radbertus published a treatise on the body of blood of the Lord. He wrote,
Though the body and blood of Christ remain in the figure of bread and wine, yet we must believe them to be simply a figure, and that after consecration they are nothing else than the body and blood of Christ.
Although his theories were attacked by some at the time, by the middle of the 11th century, we're told, his teaching had won its way to general acceptance. And a century later, an intense cult of the Blessed Sacrament developed. Writes Adolf Adam in The Liturgical Year.
In that cult, special emphasis was placed on the real presence of Christ, whole and entire, in the consecrated bread. This Eucharistic movement was accompanied by the profound desire of medieval men and women to see. This led, among other things, to the elevation of the host after the consecration, a practice first attested for Paris in 1220. 5 years earlier, the Fourth Lateran Council had decreed that the body and blood are truly contained in the sacrament of the altar under the species of bread and wine, the bread being transubstantiated into the body and the wine into the blood by the power of God.
Much later, in the mid-16th century, the Council of Trent would issue its decree on the Eucharist, in which the whole dogma of transubstantiation was spelled out in black and white.
On the Eucharist, Session 13, October 1551, Chapter 4, on Transubstantiation. Since Christ our Redeemer said that which he offered under the appearance of bread was truly his body, it has therefore always been held in the Church of God, and this Holy Synod now declares anew, that through consecration of the bread and wine there comes about a conversion of the whole substance of the bread into the substance of the body of Christ our Lord, and of the whole substance of the wine into the substance of his blood. And this conversion is by the Holy Catholic Church conveniently and properly called transubstantiation.
Back in the year 1263, the young Bohemian priest, Peter of Prague, was suffering from grave doubts about the real presence. Unable to bear it any longer, he decided to make a pilgrimage to Rome, there to pray for enlightenment at the tombs of the apostles. We don't know if Father Peter ever got to Rome, for enlightenment overtook him in the most unexpected manner. Pilgrimage in those days was difficult and dangerous. We're not told how Peter travelled, whether he was in company or alone, how long it took him, or whether he followed a special route, such as the Via Francigena, the Pilgrim's Way. All we know is that he reached Bolsena, a small town some 138 kilometres north of Rome, beside a large volcanic lake. Bolsena, for its people, was already a holy place. For many centuries earlier, during the persecution of Christians under the Emperor Diocletian, a maiden named Christina had been subjected to many tortures and then thrown into the lake with a stone round her neck by her father, furious at her conversion to Christianity. But by divine intervention, the girl returned to land, walking on that same stone. In the church of St. Christina at Bolsena, you can still see the stone with the marks of the girl's feet. Peter of Prague asked permission to offer Mass on Christina's tomb. But when the moment came to break the host after the consecration, he was unable to continue, for in his hands was a piece of flesh, dripping blood and staining the corporal in several places, and likewise the stones of the altar. The rest, you might say, is history. But whoever witnessed this miracle left no record. The guide to Bolsena writes that the priest, to avoid a scandal, picked up everything and went towards the sacristy. But the event could not be denied or hidden, and without further delay the Pope was informed. Urban IV, elected 2 years previously, was not in Rome, but in Orvieto. Rome was in a turmoil of warring factions, and Urban was never to set foot in the Eternal City. Orvieto was only 20 kilometres away, and having sent Bishop James Maltraga with St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Bonaventure to Bolsena to retrieve the precious relics, the Pope himself, with all his court, descended from the hill town to await their arrival at the bridge of Rio Chiaro. When the two processions met, they proceeded up the hill to Orvieto. For the precious corporal, a magnificent reliquary was made, and in time, the even more magnificent cathedral. The corporal is only shown to the public on two occasions, the afternoon of Easter Sunday and on the feast of Corpus Christi. This feast had, in fact, already been introduced in 1246 in the diocese of Liège by its bishop. But in 1264, Pope Urban IV, who had once been archdeacon of Liège, extended the feast to the whole church with his bull Transiturus, and Thomas Aquinas was invited to compose the office for the new feast. And what of Peter of Prague? His doubts now resolved, did he go about henceforth joyfully proclaiming the real presence? Not so, it seems. Instead, he begged to be immured in a convent cell, with only a small window opening through which food and water was passed to him. Once the tumult and the shouting had died, he too died to the world, living the rest of his life in penitence and to atone for his doubts. Pope Urban died that same year, the year following the miracle. And Bolsena? In the church of St. Christina you can still see the blood-stained stones, and a plaque on the outside wall records the visit of Pope Paul VI on the 8th of August, 1976. On that occasion, he sent a message to the Eucharistic Congress, being held at that time in Philadelphia, and with an apostolic brief raised the Church of St. Christina to the dignity of a minor basilica. Many people go to Orvieto and exclaim at the splendour of the cathedral and the beauty of the frescoes of Luca Signorelli, called upon, incidentally, to replace Fra Angelico, who, it seems, was too lavish in his use of lapis lazuli, that heavenly blue beloved of all painters. Not so many people visit the scene of the Eucharistic miracle. Bolsena is undistinguished in its architecture, though the people of Orvieto apparently contributed towards the building of a small castle, which today still dominates the town. And one might wonder and say to oneself, the ways of God are truly mysterious. For why did the Lord choose to reveal himself here, and not in Rome, at the tombs of the apostles? Why did the pilgrimage of Peter of Prague end in this undistinguished spot? There are no obvious answers, but I'll offer two of my own. The first, pragmatic, practical. God's vicar on earth, in 1223, was in Orvieto, a dozen or so miles away. Secondly, perhaps the Word made flesh looked on that great lake rich in fish, and remembering another lake, that Sea of Galilee so dear to him, chose to give this other Peter his answer here. I like to think it may have been so.
And a big thank you there to Jill Bevilacqua for sharing with us her trip to Bolsena. Finally, yet another change of pace and tone as we join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, in an effort to mark the day the Church, this past week, precisely on June the 22nd, celebrated the feast day of Saints John Fisher and Saint Thomas More. You know what I found? I found something that maybe you're interested in.
John Fisher. Oh, Lord. That's another one.
Westmonasterian, which means Westminster, I guess.
Yeah, Westmonasteriensis.
The canonization of...
the Blessed Martyrs, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and Thomas More... the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum
Cardinalis
Johannes Fisher.
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know.
I don't know how they did it. These are old Roman names.
Maybe Rochester was an old Roman.
Yeah, certainly.
And Thomas More, Tomae.
Tomae More. Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
Yeah, this is, yeah, when they're asking a question.
So
and
a
because,
doubt.
Because the doubt is in the next line with the letters here. Whether a commission should be assigned of resuming the case at hand and for the effect about which we are talking. That's the doubt. Got it? Should we resume or undertake once again the case of canonization of these people? And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, you know, yes, of course, but
this was before the founding of our radio station, because this
1930
happened in June 1930.
I see.
The 18th of June 1930.
Very good. Wonderful.
So, inter beatos martyris Angliae, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula appellabatur.
Ah, yeah. Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints, with a glorious title, two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
Stelle,
certainly.
Refulgent. Due lustrus vire tamquam stelle
refulgent. Oh, is that good? Okay, among all the blessed martyrs of England, you see, one in the high degree of ecclesiastical hierarchy, because he was a bishop, and constituted in the Episcopal order, John Cardinal Fisher.
Okay,
the Bishop of the People of Rochester.
Let's move down here. And he, I suppose Cardinal wrote this, no? Someone called Cardinal Laurenti.
Heaven's sakes.
But would this have been written in Latin by the Cardinal's office, or would there be in those days? You would have been out of a job.
I mean, we do these things every day.
Do you?
These are flunkies. You know, secretaries who do this stuff.
You're a flunky. You describe yourself as a flunky.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just blah, 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 blah.
What's a flunky in Latin?
Oh, it's naquam. Naquam. A worthless guy is a flunky. It's naquam.
You know, it's a strange thing because at Vatican Radio, we don't have a Latin program, but we have an Esperanto program.
Well, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You used to have a Latin program. Some Jesuit, and he, a Slovenian Jesuit, and then he died, and whatchamacallit, some other Jesuit said, nah, it's the end of Latin. Well, anyway.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus, anno
1480. And educated in Oxford.
Oxoni.
Pius, Oxonii Educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so on and so on. Praebat fidelibus sueba ab Chelsea. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Well, yeah, there's a certain name.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus viractus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so on.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII. If you
and
turn,
the daughters go out into the water and say, oh, salve me rex. And they address Henry VIII in Latin. When he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge?
Up
the Thames, rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit vicula sua Henricus Rex.
In fact, in this,
beautiful.
In this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph here, they speak about Henry VIII. Paulo post Rex Henricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was Iritas et Sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who? while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tentavarat had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. Mm. You see the whole story there. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony, so on and so on, de fecit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem de fecit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erected, and he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum, a standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub.
Well, we write the same thing today.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religion vultus abusu militare coagit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his, what do you say, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abuse of his royal power. Ooh, they're glorious.
They seem to dedicate more time to Thomas More than John Fisher.
Although, yeah, actually, Fisher was the most educated man around. Everyone knows that.
There's lots here in italics.
Well, these are all quotes.
Mm.
Well, that's very good and beautiful. Oh, I have to save these things. I mean, I just kind of never thought of doing this. And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. Where is this? Affirmative.
If affirmative seo signanda.
Namely that a commission should be designated of the resumption of the case if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, so that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so forth and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th in 1930.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for joining me. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Laudetur Jesus Christus.